Before the frigid water could completely take his breath away, Rafe pushed himself to a sitting position. Gasping for air and attempting to take stock of his injuries, he wondered what happened to Alexander.
"Looks like a compound fracture,"
a voice in heavily accented Russian said above the cacophony of the surf.
"You of all people know that injuries like that almost certainly lead to death in this country. Look around you, no hospital for thousands of miles."
The waves surged in across the rocky beach, and Rafe used the one arm that worked to keep his head above the icy froth.
"You were indeed a worthy adversary. Very similar to your sister. She died right here, just up the beach on those rocks. The stupid whore jumped to her death, killed one of my dogs with a bone of all things, and then took the other one with her. I never even got a shot off. The pursuit was thrilling, though. So much better than the savages we import for sport. With you, S. Rainsford, I did get a shot off. How's the shoulder? I'm about to get another shot off and add you to my collection."
As he spoke, he used the crossbow's VersaDraw system to retract the string and cock the weapon. He then loaded a short arrow from the quiver into the rail and clicked it into position on the bowstring.
"I have bested the great seal and tracker, S. Rainsford. I am the supreme hunter. You're no hunter. You're nothing but a killer. A sick, demented killer,"
Rafe spat. Anger flashed in Zharkov's eyes.
"Your friends are all dead by now. No one is coming. Sit up so I can kill you like a man."
Rafe struggled to bring his broken leg under him and get in a sitting position. He was going to face his death head on. He admired the beauty of the coastline, the rocks and gravel beneath him, the Arctic water rushing past, the sounds, the birds, the cliff, reminded him of Kodiak. And he remembered that this was exactly the reason the SEAL training facility had been built there, to mimic these conditions.
"Just remember to watch your back."
"What?"
"Someone is coming for you. Someone who will not stop until he pulls your beating heart from your chest and shows it to you. You're about to find out what it's like to be hunted."
Alexander put the crossbow to his shoulder and took aim. In all likelihood, the bolt would go right through Rafe at this distance, taking out both lungs and the heart. He wanted to preserve the head for his collection. The imperialist Navy SEAL and world-renowned hunter would be his most prized trophy.
"You'll be with your sister in a few seconds. Be sure and tell that bitch I said fuck you for killing my dogs. Her head does make an attractive trophy, though." "What was wrong?"
Alexander willed his finger to pull the trigger, but nothing was happening. He tried again, confused. His breathing was heavy, and his head felt like someone was slowly turning down the dimming switch of a light bulb. He sank to his knees on the gravel beach in front of his quarry, his crossbow falling from his grasp. He looked down to see the wooden shaft of an arrow protruding from the left side of his chest. He admired its craftsmanship, trying to place where he'd seen it before. As his body jolted forward, a second shaft appearing alongside the first. Alexander gazed at the native arrowheads in an odd mix of wonder and bewilderment, then fell forward into the crashing surf.
"Rafe! Rafe!"
Rhys scrambled down the rocks toward the beach, sliding along with the scree in a semi-controlled descent. He had watched Rafe fall to his side and disappear beneath the waves, the powerful undertow dragging him out to sea along with the man who, moments earlier, had him dead to rights. Reese hit the beach at a dead sprint, the wet pebbles doing their best to impede his progress. He crashed into the surf, arms searching desperately for his friend.
A body.
Reese held tight and heaved it out of the water, turning it over and looking into the open death stare of Alexander Zharkov.
Fuck!
Reese pushed the body away, frantically feeling for a second one. Come on! There! A shoulder rolling in the surf. Reese surged toward it as the ocean gave him one last chance.
Got him!
Reese grabbed his friend as another wave surged over them, quickly rushing back out to sea underneath itself and working to bring the two warriors along with it. Reese wrestled through the icy water, looking back at the incoming waves, dragging Rafe toward shore. He dug in to resist the undertow, then heaved forward in the brief respite between waves. In knee-deep water, then ankle-deep, Reese continued to hoist his comrade from the current that threatened to pull them into the depths. Finally, above the relative safety of the low water mark, Reese scanned the cliffs above for threats before turning his full attention to his friend. Reese had no idea what had transpired before he sent the two arrows through Zharkov's heart, so he immediately assessed his patient, worried that the cold water could mask a massive arterial bleed. Even through his pant leg, Reese could tell there was something seriously wrong with Rafe's leg. His right arm was bent in an unnatural position, the swelling increasing by the second, to say nothing of the arrow shaft that protruded from his shoulder. Reese felt for breathing and a pulse. Pulse was weak. No breathing.
Shit! Stay with me, buddy!
A quick check of Rafe's airway confirmed that it was clear, so Reese delivered two quick rescue breaths, watching his friend's chest rise and fall with the life-saving respiratory assistance. Reese jerked back as Rafe's body involuntarily lurched up, his eyes opening wide as his lungs drew in the much-needed oxygen. Rafe's eyes came to focus on the man who had just saved his life. As he returned from the dead, he was hardly able to form his first word.
Zharkov!
Reese shook his head.
It's done, brother.
Rafe closed his eyes and nodded.
We need to get you off this beach, Reese said, assessing the routes up. Get this fucking arrow out of me!
Reese knew he had to do something with the bolt. It had penetrated completely through Rafe's shoulder. The razor-sharp broadhead was projecting out his back.
Turn on your side and try to think of something pleasant.
Reese positioned his friend on his side and carefully unscrewed the arrowhead from the bolt. He then grabbed the shaft from just below the fletchings and, without warning, pulled the carbon intruder from Rafe's body. A heavy grunt was all that escaped the seal's lungs.
That wasn't as bad as I thought, Reese said. Speak for yourself. I think my leg's broken. Arm, too.
I believe you're right, Reese responded, checking Rafe's distal and pedal pulses. Don't go anywhere. Reese charged up the rocky shore and grabbed two pieces of driftwood, snapping one over his thigh before running back to his patient.
I'm going to splint these, buddy. No sense in dragging you out of here if the bones are going to grind through those arteries.
Reese attached the thicker makeshift splint to Rafe's upper leg, lashing it in place with his tourniquet and belt. He then did the same for Rafe's arm, using Zharkov's crossbow sling to secure the improvised splint in place.
How did you get here? How are we getting out?
Rafe asked.
Your dad and Thorn are coming in with the Albatross. The boys are here, too. Farkas took some shrapnel to the leg. He's in bad shape, but Eli, Devon, and Chavez are moving him to extract, along with your cellmates. Even Ito made the trip.
What? You invaded Russia?
Didn't have much choice.
And if we don't make it to extract, we are getting left behind, so let's get you up and out of here. Rafe turned his head to look at the steep scree slope before them.
I'm really glad you joined me for those workouts. Looks like I'm back to owing you one, Rafe said.
If I make it to the top of this hill, you will. Up you go,
Reese said, as he grabbed the larger man by the wrist and leg, rolling him up and into a fireman's carry. One step at a time, Reese.
Chapter 84. Reese pushed the six-wheeled off-road vehicle through the falling sleet. Rafe kept drifting in and out of consciousness in the second row of seats. Without a GPS to guide him, Reese drove toward the rising sun just visible as a lighter section of the horizon, hidden behind a gray wall of clouds. They were 2 hours late for extract, and Reese knew the odds of getting off this island with his friend were minuscule. They had launched with too little information and broke the cardinal rule of mission planning. They had no secondary or tertiary plan for extract. Everything hinged on making it to the Albatross, which Thorne would pilot as close to the wavetops as possible until hitting international airspace. Russian technology remained encapsulated in the late 1980s, which gave them a slim chance.
Never tell me the odds.
The weather was turning for the worse. If Thorne and Jonathan had delayed extract, it was likely they were all trapped on the island with no means of escape. Reese rounded a bend and turned the wheel right, leaving what passed for a road and going directly for the Bering Sea. A horseshoe-shaped cove visible through the windshield. It looked protected enough from the weather. It would be possible to get a plane in and out. The only thing missing was the plane. Reese slammed on the brakes as a lone figure stepped into their path 50 yards ahead, a Belgian-made FAL rifle pointed directly at them. Reese managed to find the door handle and pushed it open, showing his empty hands to the old gunfighter before exposing his head and identifying himself to Rafe's father. The old man lowered his rifle and charged toward the vehicle.
"What the bloody hell? Where's Rafe?"
Reese paused and closed his eyes.
"Rafe's in the back, sir. He's pretty banged up. I think a broken arm and a bad leg break, probably a concussion. If we don't get him medical attention, he's not going to make it."
The old man's eyes bore straight through the younger commando in front of him, the same green eyes as his son, asking the question without saying the words, "What happened to my daughter?"
"Eli told me, Reese. He told me. Hina is dead."
Reese's eyes filled with emotion.
I'm sorry, sir. We were too late."
Jonathan was a man accustomed to the loss that comes from a lifetime of war in the African bush, but now the old man felt a new and awful emptiness move into his soul. He'd left the death, the executions, the genocide, and the torture behind on the dark continent, and even so, the darkness had found him. Now his youngest was gone. Her wild spirit was free. "Jonathan," Reese said in a measured tone, "we have to get out of here. How long ago did the plane leave?"
The usually stoic old warrior swallowed hard. He'd aged a decade since Montana.
"Jonathan?"
"They left an hour ago. Thorne, Farkas, Devon, Eli, and Chavez, along with the prisoners. Farkas wasn't doing well. Those crazy bastards all wanted to stay, but I wouldn't hear of it. They'd done enough. If my son and daughter weren't leaving this island, then I wasn't either. I couldn't go home without my children. They could go home to theirs."
"Attu Island is our only way out. It's directly east. Load up."
"What are you going to do, lad? Drive there?"
"There has got to be a way to communicate in that lodge. These Russians had working night vision, which means they had a secure area where whatever they hit us with to take out our electronics wouldn't penetrate. We need to find it and reach the naval base on Attu."
"No one is going to send the Coast Guard to invade Russia and rescue us. We're a band of mercenaries. Thorne and the team are probably getting locked up as we speak. I saw it in Africa, Reese. No one is coming but Russians. I plan on taking as many as I can with me before I go."
Reese nodded in understanding. He had wanted to die when his wife and daughter were taken from him, and he'd wanted to kill as many of those responsible before he went down. He opened his mouth to argue, but another voice broke through the sub-Siberian air, an American voice with no hint of a Russian accent. Drop your weapons or die. Chapter 85. Reese and Jonathan instinctively went to a knee as three dark, dry suit clad commandos holding M4 carbines converged on their position.
Names,
the unknown voice commanded.
Fuck you,
Jonathan hissed. Reese pushed his FAL toward the ground.
It's okay, Reese said before directing his attention to the new threat. I'm James Reese. I'm here with Rafe and Jonathan Hastings.
I'd ask you the word of the day, but I'm sure you don't know it,
the man who was obviously in charge said as he moved in closer, lowering his rifle.
I'm Lieutenant Kevin O'Malley, SDV Team 1. You guys must be pretty important to divert us from a...
Redacted. Paragraph redacted.
We've got a man down in the back of the truck, Reese said, moving to his feet. He can't walk and needs a medic. Multiple EKIA are down. I don't think there are any others, but Russian military is probably inbound.
Oh, they're inbound, all right, the SEAL leader confirmed. Charlie 01 to Nautilus, I pass touchdown. I say again, touchdown,
the platoon commander said into his OSK headset. Then, hitting a push-to-talk attached to what Reese recognized as an L3 Harris ANPRC-163 handheld radio, he said,
Charlie 1-1, call in the Z-Birds and send Spanky up. We've got a non-ambulatory friendly here.
O'Malley put out his hand.
Nice to meet you, sir. I've heard a lot about you.
Not sure what you're doing in Russia, but whatever it is, we are here to get you out.
The team's medic emerged out of the morning light and climbed into the odd-looking 6x6 to assess his patient.
What happened?
He asked as his hands checked for a pulse and worked his way down Rafe's body.
He took a tumble off a cliff and nearly drowned, Reese replied. That was after he was shot with a crossbow. Is he going to make it?
He's hypothermic. He's breathing and has strong distal pulses, but these displaced compound fractures have me worried. Starting IV. Need to get him to the IDC. We need to extract now,
the medic directed at his platoon commander. O'Malley turned back to Reese.
Sir, we have got to get you off this beach. We have a JMAU SRT standing by. He'll be in good hands. The extract platforms are on their way. They might be a little different than the ones you used. Sub is waiting for us 4 nautical miles out.
What? How did you know where we were?
Above my pay grade, O'Malley said, clearly not sure what he was allowed to divulge. All I know is that this is an agency-directed op. We have a maritime branch liaison on the sub with us who helped coordinate.
A change in the tone of the surf caused Reese to pick his head up.
That's our ride, O'Malley said in response to Reese's questioning look.
The two Zodiacs, or combat rubber raiding craft, that emerged out of the fog looked more akin to stealth fighters than the Z-Birds Reese had used in the teams.
Times change, O'Malley said before keying his mic. Chief, we need a couple guys to help carry. Time to load up.
Two SEALs wearing dark green dry suits materialized from the perimeter, and two more maneuvered up the beach from the Black Zodiacs. One carried a Skedco tactical sked that he transformed into a stretcher in the center of the perimeter. They all assisted the medic in moving Rafe's broken and unconscious body from the vehicle and strapped him into the green flexible plastic stretcher, IV bag on his chest. Reese grabbed a handle and heard O'Malley say, "Moving," into his radio. They patrolled toward the ocean, toward freedom, the naval commandos bracketing the stretcher in a tight diamond formation with weapons up looking for threats. As they reached the surf zone, Reese could see that their extraction platforms were very similar to the Zodiacs he'd used in the teams, but had what looked to be a radar deflecting or absorbing shell over the top to eliminate or reduce radar signature. The engines were muffled or possibly even electric to reduce sound. The naval commandos turned the boats so the bows were pointed back out to sea in a well-practiced maneuver. They loaded from the front as the helmsman timed the waves, waiting for everyone to climb aboard, judging his opportunity to race through the breakers. As they loaded Rafe into their extract platform, Reese turned to Jonathan, and over the sound of the cascading surf pulled him close.
"I'm not coming with you."
"What the bloody hell?" My mission's not over. You go. Get home to Caroline. Mourn your daughter. Take care of Rafe. Also, I need you to talk with Thorne and have him get in touch with Vic Rodriguez at the CIA. It is imperative that he lets the agency think I made it back with you through official channels. The Russians can't think I'm still here.
Get in the boat, you bloody idiot!
Jonathan shot back. The man who killed my father is here. Not on Medni, but he's close, and I know where. Overhearing the conversation, Lieutenant O'Malley turned, the angry sea surging around his waist, the other operators looking impatiently at their senior officer.
Sir, my orders are to bring you back. We can't have an American captured dead or alive on Russian soil.
Don't worry, Lieutenant, I have a history of doing things like this.
You'll never leave here alive, son.
Jonathan's demeanor changed as he unslung his FAL and handed it to the former frogman. If that's true, I want you to tell Katie something for me.
What's that?
Semper. With that, Rhys turned and sprinted back up the beach. Chapter 86. Siberia, Russian Far East. Winter. As winter settled upon the harsh land, a rumor began to swirl among the villages of the Krasnoyarsk Krai. A ghost was moving across the tundra, sometimes taking the shape of the animals that inhabited the wilderness. Some of the stories described him as half-man and half-beast. Still others were sure one of the brown bears that inhabited the interior had killed a nomadic hunter, merging their souls. The stories were passed along in the way they had since the first peoples had moved into this land, following the herds that gave them sustenance. The ghost would occasionally steal food and supplies from villages along his path, always a gift left in exchange. No one knew his destination, but it was rumored he was heading west, toward what or whom was unknown. Mothers maintained an attentive eye on their children, keeping them closer than usual. Fathers and hunters took an extra minute to pause and study the landscape before closing their doors at night. Once, a village heard a gunshot in the distance. Even specters had to eat. A native kayak had been found by children playing on the peninsula. It had been dragged into the tree line. Its owner was nowhere to be found. A motorcycle had disappeared in Elita, and the phantom had stolen a snowmobile in Tanzi Bay. When the men of the settlement caught up with it, it was abandoned and empty of gas. An offering of fresh meat was on the seat as payment, tracks of native snowshoes leading off into the snow. The men knew better than to track an apparition, wearing snowshoes or not. That would not end well. It was best not to meddle in the ways of the spirit world. The wise old men of the villages believed the hunter was caught between this world and the next. He was on a journey and wouldn't rest until it was done. Village to village the rumor spread, some leaving offerings to the spirit as he drifted across the land, flour, smoked fish, sugar. On he went, passing villages and settlements, in his natural element moving toward his target. He had never felt so free. There was only the hunt. Chapter 87. Krasnoyarsk Krai, Russia, 6 months later. Rhys had spent days watching from his hide site in the hillside. The animal skins kept him warm, and the marmot jerky he'd most recently dried nourished his body. He knew he'd lost weight and muscle mass moving over 2,000 kilometers across Siberia, hunting for the man who had killed his father. Hate kept him warm. Thoughts of Katie, his homeland, his future, were buried. He had built fires when he was able, slept in snow caves or debris shelters, and kept moving. One step at a time, always forward. He used the FAL sparingly. The bow became his primary weapon for the procurement of food. He preferred it that way.
He traveled as the ancient hunter-gatherers had moved, nomads following the migrating herds, foraging as they went, in a constant struggle to survive. Rhys had a different purpose that pushed him forward. A violent nomad, he had a mission. Death. He knew they'd come. The MI-8 circled and landed on the gravel HLZ just outside the main house. An older man emerged from the helicopter first, the lead from the advance detail running to the chopper door to escort him and his guest to the relative warmth of the dacha. Then came the little man. At this distance, a positive identification was not possible, but Rhys was not working within the confines of the law. Rhys knew. The small man bundled up against the cold was his prey. The traitor, Oliver Gray. Rhys would watch for another day, and then make his move.
Oliver, why do you keep looking out that window?
Ivan Zharkov asked, looking up from the stove. He preferred to cook for himself when he was at the dacha. It reminded him of his humble beginnings. His children had missed the struggle of the early days, and that saddened him. While he had been forged through adversity, his children had grown up with the trappings of wealth which bred a softness. All except Alexander, whose sickness had been his downfall. There's not even a fence out there, Pakhan.
That is because Siberia is our fence. Even the native people only infringe on the very edges. Superstitious about the event that gave us this beautiful land.
Oliver had known about what the world termed the Tunguska event and had heard Zharkov tell of his connection to the area many times. The old man was fascinated with it.
The indigenous Evenks and Yakuts believe a deity sent a fireball as a warning. It was one they heeded. It destroyed 2,000 square kilometers, Oliver. Those that didn't initially believe were convinced afterward, when the sky glowed for days.
Did they ever figure out what it was? Asked Oliver, knowing there had been numerous theories and speculation over the years.
There was no crater. Some think it was a meteor that disintegrated before impact, the soft ground devouring its remains, absorbing its power. Others say it was an underground volcano. It may have been a comet, its ice becoming part of the land. I've even heard that it could have been a small black hole colliding with Earth. No one really knows. Over 110 years later, it remains the largest recorded impact event in recorded history, and nobody knows what it was. Regardless, we are in the epicenter of that event. Everything for 800 miles in every direction was destroyed except for right here. Those trees are all that are left, he said, gesturing out the large windows before him. Like the Genbaku Dome at the epicenter of the Hiroshima bomb the Americans dropped on Japan, those trees are all that remain. We too shall remain, Oliver. With the changing tides of geopolitics, the Bratva will remain.
I think you should still have additional security measures in place, Pakhan. If James Rhys comes, our guards won't stop him.
Oliver, how many times must we discuss this? Our source in the United States confirms that James Rhys is in Maryland. I have people watching the airports, train stations, shipyards, all ports of entry. Have his facial recognition data in their systems. He won't set foot inside Mother Russia without us knowing. He did take care of a rather nasty problem for me. Alexander is no longer a threat, planning to push the old lion out of the pride. My other children are enjoying their spoiled lives as the progenies of a Russian oligarch. There is nothing but tundra and wild animals in every direction.
James Reese is not going to let me go, Pachan.
Oliver diverted his attention back out the windows that overlooked the helipad. Lights from the generators illuminated all sides of the compound. Beyond that was darkness. Stirring the borscht on the stovetop, Zharkov continued.
Do you know what would have happened had that impact event occurred just 4 hours later?
Oliver turned back to his new mentor, his brain searching for an answer.
Think about it, Oliver. The rotation of the Earth would have centered the hit on my very home city of St. Petersburg. In 1908, the capital of the empire would have been destroyed. I would have never existed. In all likelihood, there would have been no Soviet Union. The German army would not have had an Eastern Front to contend with, and would have been able to put all efforts into defeating the Allies in the West. No Cold War. It would be a different world.
As one of the most powerful men in Russia, Zharkov drew strength from what he considered a sacred place. Oliver was not so sure. He would have much rather been at one of the more opulent dachas on the Black Sea, where the other oligarchs chose to invest their considerable wealth, and where Zharkov's broods enjoyed the fruits of their father's labor. But Oliver was not in a position to dictate the schedule to the head of the Brotherhood. The pleasant smell of the red beetroot soup calmed him. He turned his eyes outward from the epicenter of what had been a 15-megaton explosion, out from the heart of Bratva Power, toward the blackness, wondering what was beyond it. Reese had counted 9 total, the 3 in the advance team who had been dropped off 2 days prior, and the 3 that arrived with Zharkov and Gray. That plus the pilot made 9. Reese didn't factor in the odds of 1 man against 9 he'd faced worse. He only knew he was going to kill them all. The explosion threw Oliver to the floor. In a panic, he looked to his benefactor, who gripped the stove with a wild excitement in his eyes. Had the gods returned to Krasnoyarsk Krai? 2 men from Zharkov's security element immediately entered the room. Ensuring their principal was alive, they took positions away from the windows, holding their AKMs at the 2 entrances to the room, with the senior man shouting into his radio. They wouldn't dare push the leader of the Bratva to the ground, though they all knew that is where he should be. Pachan, the man who had just been on his radio said as he moved to the side of his boss.
There's been an explosion at the front of the dacha. It destroyed the truck and killed Grigory, Misha, and Viktor.
Nikolai Christenko had been GRU before being lured into the world of organized crime. He'd been to the dacha many times with Zharkov, and, though he did not believe in the superstitions surrounding the area, it had always made him feel uneasy.
What was it?
We don't know, Pachan, but we need to move you to a more secure location.
Da,
the elder mafioso said and nodded, though Nikolai suspected he would rather stay and find out if the fireball from the heavens really did come from a supernatural source.
Pachan, we have to leave,
a terrified Oliver pleaded, as he scampered toward the relative safety of the stove. Zharkov looked at the former CIA man and to his head of security. He then decided their fate. Reese had waited until he had as many of Zharkov's security personnel in the kill zone as possible before detonating the explosives. He'd emplaced the MON-50 devices 2 weeks earlier after watching the empty dacha for 3 days to ensure it was unoccupied. Reese had taken a foreign weapons course years ago and was familiar with the anti-personnel device developed in the former Soviet Union and exported around the world. Its green body was easy to camouflage in the tundra turned soft by the melting snow. It had been set for use against him and his team on Medney Island, where Reese had collected it before beginning his journey westward into the interior. It worked precisely as designed, destroying the Laplander vehicle parked out front and ripping half of Zharkov's security detail to shreds. If one was not going to walk, there was only one way out of Krasnoyarsky Krai, and its rotors were already beginning to turn.
Idti, idti! Go, go!
Nikolai shouted as the turbines of the MI-8 spooled up, ushering his boss and his underling toward their extraction platform. The youngest man on the detail knelt by the helo, weapon pointed out into the unknown. Reese knew he had to work quickly. The FAL was not equipped with a suppressor, which meant that its muzzle flash would be visible to the security detail.
Prioritize the threats.
The fore end of the stock was nestled securely on the leather satchel he had carried, first through Kamchatka and across the Sea of Okhotsk, and then on to the mainland, and then by foot across Siberia. The fire from the still-burning Laplander off-road truck he'd destroyed moments earlier provided just enough illumination for him to use his iron sights. Covered in the mossy green tundra that had once absorbed the most powerful impact event in modern history, his position was located outside the ring of the light. Fire had once provided safety to those who stood within its sphere, warding off tigers, leopards, and bears. Now that light from the burning vehicle was the death knell for those it illuminated. 6 targets. Only 5 bullets remained. As the group of 4 men arrived at the helicopter door, Reese's finger depressed the trigger. His first bullet caught a man kneeling by the helo directly between the nose and mouth, showering the rear security in brain particles. Before his AKM could answer, 2 7.62x51 rounds from Reese's rifle took him in the upper chest just above his body armor and sent him crashing into the front of the helo and onto the cold ground. Seeing men falling around his helicopter, the pilot yanked up on the collective and increased pitch even before his passengers had boarded the aircraft. Nikolai shouted over the chaos, beckoning the pilot to return the bird to the ground. He'd be executed later for his insolence and cowardice. Nikolai then watched in horror as the pilot's body contorted violently, the helo just 8 feet off the ground. Reese's last 2 rounds had entered under the pilot's right arm, tearing through his body, before exiting through the glass on the opposite side of the helicopter. The pilot lurched forward against the stick as a bloody froth erupted from his mouth and nostrils, inadvertently pushing down on the collective and sending the chopper in a violent left spin. The rotors tore up the gravel walkway, the sounds of metal thrashing against the earth permeating the taiga, before the giant bird cartwheeled into the dacha. Nikolai pushed his principal to the ground as the machine collided with the wood structure. He knelt and let loose with a fully automatic burst from the Russian rifle he knew so well. Reese waited in the prone position, his rifle now a useless piece of metal without the ammunition to sustain it. He watched the Russian take Zharkov to the ground and fire in the general direction of where he perceived the threat to be. As he brought the AKM into his workspace to change magazines, Reese stood, drew the ancient weapon that had been his constant companion since leaving Medney Island, and sent an arrow into the left eye socket of Zharkov's head of security. Oliver Gray gawked in horror at the wooden shaft protruding from Nikolai's head, visible in the dancing light that escaped from the burning helicopter and vehicle. Imagining a similar fate for himself, he turned to run, tripping and falling to the rocks.
"Stop, Oliver!"
his benefactor commanded, himself rising to his feet and brushing himself off.
"Let us meet our tormentor face to face, shall we?"
Was this man mad?
He couldn't believe this was a supernatural deity, could he? Those were gunshots, for Christ's sake, and the object sticking out of Nikolai's face was an arrow.
Oliver's attention shifted from the arrow to the darkness outside the ring of fire as one of the shadows began to shift. James Reese took a step forward. He'd been covered by the peat moss of the tundra for close to 3 days. The skins he'd stolen from native villages and others he'd tanned with the brains of animals he'd killed en route, creating an insulated makeshift burrow. His muscles were stiff from the patient act of lying in wait for his prey. He left the FAL where it was, out of ammunition, now just a vestige of his odyssey, a link to his past. He slipped the tomahawk from its sheath on his belt and felt its weight in his hand. It felt right. Slinging his bow into the skin sheath on his back, he walked into the light. Oliver did as he was told and pushed himself to his feet, looking from Ivan to the shape-shifting shadow that emerged from the wilderness. At first, Oliver wondered if perhaps Zharkov's conjecture was not as far off as it had first seemed. Perhaps deities really did roam the tundra, guarding it from intruders. What emerged looked half-human, half-beast, and it wasn't until the flickering flame caught the creature just right that Oliver saw it was a man. He was covered in animal skins, as if he'd taken on their very essence. When the light caught his eyes, Oliver recognized the look of resolve. His executioner had arrived.
"James Reese," the Russian mafia boss began, almost in disbelief. "I see my source in D.C. has been compromised."
Even though the specter of the former SEAL had been his constant companion for months, Oliver never imagined that his killer would take the form that appeared before him. Reese took a moment before responding, his mouth and lungs not accustomed to forming words after not having spoken in the 6 months since he'd left Medney Island.
"I'd say that's a safe assumption," he said.
The words were raspy, akin to starting an old car left idle for too long. Oliver remained silent, his eyes now focused on the evil-looking tomahawk in Reese's hand. The elder Russian's gaze recognized the pelt of the great Siberian brown bear that now adorned the phantom before him.
"And you walked across Siberia to kill us?" he asked.
"Yes."
"Remarkable,"
the elder man said, shaking his head.
"Before you do, allow me to thank you for putting my son out of his misery. I should have done it myself years ago, but blood, you see, difficult business."
"You just allowed Alexander to play his sick games on Medney?"
"He was a very highly placed asset in Russian intelligence, and he was family. More of an arrangement of necessity. If transporting a few prisoners to Kamchatka, who would have otherwise been executed in the African dirt, was the price to pay for controlling a percentage of the diamond and uranium trade, and keeping a source in the Foreign Intelligence Service, then so be it. Sadly, he did have designs on my position, and I fear would have expedited my demise had you not come along."
Reese shifted his eyes to his new target, the man who had killed his father, the man who had one piece of information Reese needed. How could this little, balding, frightened, pot-bellied man have killed Thomas Reese?
"Don't underestimate him. You have something that belongs to me," Reese said.
The smaller man's shaking hand moved to his wrist and removed a stainless steel watch, holding it out toward his judge, jury, and executioner. Reese stepped forward and took possession of his father's Rolex. He slid his thumb across its worn face before dropping it into the sheath with his bow.
"Nizar the sniper. Nizar Katan, the Syrian. Where is he?"
Oliver sensed an opportunity. He might just live through this night, if he played his cards right.
I don't know.
Then you are of no use to me, Reese responded, raising the tomahawk.
Wait, wait, I didn't say I couldn't find him. He was part of Andrenov's network, through General Yadid, both of whom you killed, I believe?
Keep talking. Oliver acted as though he were deep in thought.
It will take some doing. He is a freelancer now, but I know his protocols and patterns. I can find him for you, but I can't do that if I'm dead.
Reese lowered the hawk. The traitor before him had killed his father using a proxy, stabbing him to death on the streets of Buenos Aires. He'd betrayed his country and helped set up a chemical attack on Odessa, the assassination of the Russian president, and the attempted assassination of the president of the United States. This same traitor just might be the only link to the Syrian sniper who had put a bullet through Reese's friend as Freddie had thwarted the assassination attempt on the U.S. president. The only reason Freddie was in the path of the assassin's bullet was Reese. Reese was responsible. Reese needed to find Nizar and put him down. He owed that to Freddie and to Freddie's wife and children, perhaps even to himself. His decision made, Reese turned back to Zharkov, a cold breeze picking up and fanning the flames still smoldering in the driveway. "And what of us, then?" Reese asked the elder Russian.
"Yes, what of us?" Zharkov responded. "He killed your father, you killed my son. Very Shakespearean."
"Only in that it is all a tragedy," Reese acknowledged.
"By killing my son, you saved my life, Mr. Reese. Allow me to repay the favor. Allow me to offer you safe passage out of Russia."
Reese looked at the old man quizzically.
"Come, Mr. Reese, how did you expect to get home? Walk back across Siberia and kayak across the strait?"
The thought had crossed my mind.
"You can't be serious."
"It's been done before."
"That it has. As sick as my son was, he had friends in Russian intelligence, friends who would not take kindly to an American invasion of the motherland or the killing of one of their senior intelligence officers, Bratva connected or otherwise. If they suspect you are still in Russia, they will find you."
"So in exchange for your life, you get me out of Russia?"
"Yes. We will use the satellite phone inside to call in another helo. My network will get you to the Black Sea, and from there you will board a flight to the Central African Republic. I'm afraid I can't do much more for you from there. You will have to make contact with the Americans at their embassy in Bangui. You will be on your own at that point, but you will be alive."
Reese took a moment to take stock of the situation and then slowly nodded. "I want to discuss something with you privately," Reese said to the head of Russian organized crime.
"Oliver, go to the house to get the sat phone. Mr. Reese and I have additional business."
Happy to still be breathing, Oliver said, "Yes, Pakan," and limped toward the main home. Reese remained quiet, watching Oliver Gray move up the gravel walkway. Memories of his father raced through his mind. Road trips in their old Wagoneer, hikes in the Northern California redwoods, canoeing the boundary waters, fishing the Taylor, and learning to live in harmony with the land out of their trapper's cabin in Alaska. He thought of the three of them, mother, father, and son, holding hands around the dinner table, saying grace over a meal of wild game.
"What was it you wanted to discuss, Mr. Reese?" interrupted Zharkov.
Oliver was nearing the back door to the house. He would make a call on the sat phone before bringing it out to the old man, informing Zharkov's security forces that an American was holding them hostage and that he should be shot as soon as reinforcements arrived, regardless of what Zharkov was about to tell them. The old man was under duress and was being threatened with death by the crazy American.
"Yes, that would work. James Reese was just as stupid as his father. Gray? Oliver heard the American call out. The former CIA man turned and looked back down the slight hill toward the man who moments before had held his life in his hands. Reese reached into his pocket and pulled out a small, oblong box and held it above his head. A wire led from the box to the ground at his feet, angling up toward the dacha. I changed my mind. Reese depressed the detonator on the last Russian claymore, sending an electrical charge to the embedded blasting cap, detonating 700 grams of RDX, which explosively propelled 485 short steel rods at 4,000 feet per second through what had, less than a second before, been Oliver Gray. The explosion that sent Gray to the afterlife took the aging mafia boss by surprise. He recovered quickly and looked back to Reese.
And then there were two, Zharkov quipped. He had just outgrown his usefulness.
Reese chose his next words carefully. Mr. Zharkov, I have a proposal for you.
I am listening.
Get me out of Russia, to CAR. I'll find my way home from there. In the meantime, I want you looking into everything you can find on Nizar Khatan, the Syrian sniper who helped take out President Zubarov last year. You must still have contacts at the SVR. Use them. Get me something actionable.
Don't you have the CIA?
Nizar was employed by a Russian through a Syrian proxy. I think you might have better access.
And what do I get out of this little agreement? Asked the Russian, ever the dealmaker.
Reese looked at the tomahawk in his hand. In the short term, I won't skin you alive. Longer term, you will have a back-channel connection to the CIA.
Are you offering to spy for me, Mr. Reese?
No. I am offering you a way to contact me. I'll run any request you have up the chain, but know that even that access could be extremely valuable to you and your organization.
And if I don't agree?
Then there's my short-term fix, Reese said, giving the Winkler Seok a spin in his palm.
You Americans are too trusting, Mr. Reese. How do you know I won't agree and just have you killed when my detail arrives, or change my mind a month from now and send hit teams to kill you wherever you are?
Because you are a practical man. I killed your son for you, and this alliance will help us both. If you have your men kill me, I have a friend who is even better in the woods than I am. Your son killed his sister, put her head in a bottle of formaldehyde. He'll finish you off, and trust me, he won't be as kind about it as I would be. And if you betray me later, I found you once in the middle of Siberia. Don't think I can't or won't do it again. I kind of like it out here. The elder Zharkov weighed his options.
I accept your offer, Mr. Reese. My son was a killer. We are hunters. I give you my word that no harm will come to you. I will guarantee your safe passage as far as Africa. From there, you are on your own.
And, Ivan, if you fuck me, I'll track you down and kill you in your own kitchen. Not only that, I'll kill your sons. All of them. I will erase the Zharkov name from existence. Your legacy will be that an American wiped your bloodline from the earth. Epilogue. Deep in the forest, a call was sounding. Jack London, The Call of the Wild. Baltimore, Maryland. Reese waited on a darkened section of street, rain pelting his rented Chevy Tahoe half a block down from the long-term storage facility in Baltimore, Maryland. The engine was on to keep the defroster working, but his lights were off. The facility was ringed in barbed wire and security cameras. Signs advertised a guard. He observed the entrance for an hour. No one came or went. It was open 24/7, if you had the right keys and an ID. Reese had waited until well after midnight to cut down on the number of people he might encounter. In this part of the city, that didn't necessarily make it safer, but Reese wanted to be alone. He'd been back in the States for 6 weeks, debriefing at an off-site CIA annex in Northern Virginia.
They needed him close by as they figured out what to do. A team of American mercenaries, well, technically not mercenaries, as none of them had accepted payment, had invaded a sovereign country and killed the Russian deputy director of their foreign intelligence service, who just happened to be the son of the head of one of the most powerful organized crime syndicates in Russia. One of these mercenaries had stayed behind and traveled deep into the interior, killing an American defector from the Central Intelligence Agency. Everything was being kept very low-key as the CIA and executive branch figured out how best to play it. The Associated Press had picked up a story of the slaying of a Russian intelligence official that first appeared in the Moscow daily Rossiyskaya Gazeta and on television from the state-owned news agency Novosti. The mafia-related assassination received little mention from U.S.-based mainstream media, who were all much more concerned with the circus surrounding the upcoming presidential election. Receiving even less attention was the admission of a red-haired male to a Level 2 trauma center in Anchorage with a mysterious piece of shrapnel in his leg. Alaskans were notorious for serious injuries that came as a matter of course, as a result of the inherently dangerous professions that drew people to America's 49th state. The emergency surgery that saved his life was even covered under TRICARE. In a not-so-random visit, the White House log indicated that the day the mercenaries departed for Russia, the director of Central Intelligence made an unscheduled 3 o'clock a.m. visit to the president's residence. A meeting took place in the Situation Room, a meeting in which only two people were present. It lasted 30 minutes. The next hour, an Ohio-class special operations-capable SSGN submarine was diverted from a national tasking off North Korea and positioned off the coast of Russia. Because of the sensitivities that enshroud the subsurface fleet, this move went unnoticed and unreported by military and intelligence watchdogs. In the weeks since Reese's return, prominent D.C. lobbyist Grant LaRue had mysteriously gone missing, at the same time the president's chief of staff, Reginald Pine, had resigned, citing personal reasons. Journalists and conspiracy theorists had yet to connect the two events. True to his word, Ivan Zharkov had used his illicit network to deposit Reese on a dusty airstrip in the Central African Republic. The CIA chief of station in Bangui was more than a little surprised when an American who looked like a homeless mountain man appeared at the front gate. Calls were made, bona fides were confirmed, and Reese found himself on a secure video teleconference with Vic Rodriguez. To the director of clandestine services' agitated and probing inquisition, Reese simply answered, "Just get me home, Vic." Police sirens stirred Reese from his reverie, the blue and red flashing lights screaming by on the way to yet another call. Reese turned on the lights and put his SUV in drive, approaching the front gate and waving to the guard, who manned the facility from behind a horizontal sliding barrier. The guard hit a button, and the iron gate rolled out of the way, allowing Reese to inch forward.
"Can I help you?"
"I'm looking for container 1855. I haven't been here in years. Can you tell me where it is?"
"Name?"
"Thomas Reese." The guard scrolled through a database, confirming that Thomas Reese had a container in the storage facility and that he was fully paid up. Finding everything in order, he asked for Reese's ID. Reese pushed the ID through the open window of his vehicle, intentionally holding his finger over the first name. The guard yawned, consulted a map, and drew a circle on it before handing it to Reese and pointing into the labyrinth.
"Take your first right and then the next left. It'll be about halfway down."
"Thank you," Reese said. The lone guard nodded and went back to a night of monitoring security cameras, drinking lukewarm coffee, and eating stale donuts left over from the day shift. Reese drove slowly past row upon row of storage units until he found himself parked outside number 1855. When his mother had passed away, the last of his family's belongings had been sent to Katie's father. The Baranics were listed as the next of kin after Reese. Because Reese was believed to be dead, Three boxes had eventually been shipped from his mother's nursing home closet to Dr. Baranek, who ultimately sent them to Katie to give to Reese. Katie had been none too pleased when Reese turned up at the U.S. Embassy in the Central African Republic 6 months after she had seen him off. When he had not returned, both Rafe and Jonathan had paid her a visit. They had been smart enough to call ahead so Katie wouldn't think they were arriving to give her the news that Reese was dead. She'd lived that nightmare once before. Reese thought he would be welcomed back with open arms, but found, much to his dismay, that Katie was pissed. Though the making up had been worth it, they decided that Reese should have his own place, as he was debriefed at Langley and figured out his next move. Rodriguez wanted him full-time at the agency, but Reese needed time. Time to figure out this next chapter in life. His next mission. Purpose. Reese had waited until he was alone to unpack the boxes of memories from the nursing home. As he worked his way through old family photos and mementos from happier times, he'd come across a cigar box containing some military photographs from Vietnam, his dad's DD-214, the paperwork everyone who has served in uniform since 1950 has received upon discharge from active duty, and an envelope containing a key. An address was printed on the envelope, the address of the storage facility. Reese stood in the pouring rain outside the storage container and rubbed the key in his hand. The journey that had started with the death of his father in a back alley of Buenos Aires was finally over. The miles logged and bodies stacked since that pivotal moment had chiseled Reese into the warrior he was today. Why, as he stood in the rain looking down at the key, did he not feel a sense of closure? The man behind his father's death and the killing of Freddie Strain was now in the ground, just fertilizer for the Siberian tundra. The traitor's death begot life. Looking right and left for threats, Reese carefully inspected the corners of the roll-up door with a handheld light, then checked the area around the lock before kneeling down to work the brass key into the old master lock. It took some maneuvering to get it in and twist it, the mechanism fouled with years of grime and dust. True to form, it clicked open and Reese slid it from its post. "What secrets are you hiding?" Reese wondered. He could have used his agency contacts to look into who was paying the monthly fees, but Reese didn't want to alert the most powerful spy agency in the world that one of their former case officers who died under mysterious circumstances had a storage unit set up to outlive him. Reese wanted to see what was inside first. He pocketed the lock and key and pulled up on the door. As with the lock, it took a bit of work to get it up to knee level, at which point Reese squatted down and pushed it up. Darkness. Reese retrieved the light from his pocket. Out of habit, he held it in his left hand, his right remaining free to go to the gun, if need be. The light moved slowly from left to right, revealing an empty shelving unit on the left and a tarp over what appeared to be a vehicle. He approached with caution, walking around the car and looking underneath it for anywhere the dust was more recently disturbed. It had been backed in. Tom Reese Combat parked, just like his son. Seeing nothing that set off any alarms, he went to the front left corner and pulled back the cover. Reese couldn't help but smile. There, looking none the worse for wear, was his father's 1985 Grand Wagoneer. The tires were low and the left rear was clearly flat, leaving the old Jeep much like a football player past his prime, sitting on the bench waiting for that one last play. He wiped the driver's side window with his sleeve and peered through with his light. Looking at the handle for anything that looked cleaner than the rest of the vehicle, he pressed the button and slowly cracked the door. Shining his light up and down the broken seal, he examined it for anything unusual, particularly wires. Once again, all clear. Pulling the door all the way open, Reese used his light to inspect the front and passenger rows. Sliding into the driver's seat, Reese put his hands on the wheel, remembering. He then leaned over and opened the glove box, rustling through some oil change receipts and a tattered owner's manual. Craning his neck, he looked in the rear seats.
Nothing. Maybe Dad just left me an old Wagoneer? No. There is something else.
Thomas Rees wouldn't take such pains to ensure a storage unit in Baltimore would receive monthly payments 15 years past his death so that someone could one day discover an old Jeep rotting away. Rees exited the vehicle in which he had so many wonderful memories and walked to the back of the classic truck. The window was down, and Rees suppressed a chuckle. He'd learned more than a few swear words listening to his old man curse the notoriously inoperable motorized backsliding window that had to be down before opening the tailgate. Rees depressed the button on the back of his tack light and looked into the storage area. An aluminum rifle case gleamed back. Even all these years later, Rees remembered exactly how to drop the gate. He reached inside and pulled up on the handle, assisting the drop into position. "What did you leave behind, Dad?" Rees whispered. Positioning the case across the gate, Rees inspected the clasps. A small travel lock secured the contents. Rees hesitated briefly to take a look at every point where the rectangular case might have been tampered with. Again, clear. Putting his light in his mouth, he pulled his Winkler Dynamis Combat Flathead from his back pocket, a tool that looked like the most aggressive screwdriver in existence. He inserted it between the shackle and body of the lock, aggressively pulling back on the tool, and snapped open the padlock. He then flipped its closures and opened the box. There, lying in the foam cut out to keep it secure, was a duckbill-modified Ithaca 37 shotgun with a pistol grip and canvas sling. Rees pulled his father's weapon of choice as point man in the jungles of Vietnam from its resting place and examined it. With the extended tube, Rees knew it held 8 rounds. 4 boxes of number 4 shot were nestled into the foam. That's it? As much as Rees admired the tried-and-true Model 37, he had expected something more. A truck and a 12-gauge? Something didn't fit. If his dad wanted to leave him a Jeep and shotgun, he would have just left them in his garage. The top left corner of the box caught his trained eye, the foam just a bit out of place. Rees pinched it with his fingers and pulled the top layer out of the case and onto the rifle, a key and a letter falling out with it. Intrigued, Rees went for the key, a safe deposit box key. Rees rolled it in his fingers and inspected it in the light. Nothing to show where it came from. The letter. Rees reached for it. Sealed, he turned it over in his hands. It was addressed to James Rees in his father's hand. A message from the grave? Rees broke the seal, pulled out the letter, swallowed hard, and began to read. He read it quickly at first. Then he went back to the beginning and read it again, hearing his dad's voice breathe life into the words that leapt from the page. When he was done, he slowly refolded it and placed it back into the envelope from which it came, before putting it and the safe deposit box key in his pocket. Then, moving back to the front of the old truck, he took a seat behind the wheel. He watched the rain hitting his Tahoe and the ground around it, each drop an attempt from Mother Nature to cleanse and refresh the world below. Rees stared out the window in a self-imposed trance, his car illuminated every few minutes by a crack of lightning, losing track of time as memories of his father, his mother, the old Wagoneer, Buds, his wife and daughter, Iraq, Afghanistan, Siberia, Freddie, Nizar, and Katie, the living and the dead, passed through his mind's eye. Pulling a burner phone from his pocket, Rees pressed in a memorized 10-digit number, hit send, and brought it to his ear. The director of clandestine services answered on the first ring, and Rees gave Vic his answer.
Savage Son, a thriller, was written by Jack Carr and read by Ray Porter. It was recorded by Tim Moore at York Recording Studios in Los Angeles, with editing and post-production by like 2,000 pounds. The associate producer was Claire Tadakoro. Savage Son was produced and directed by Travis Tunn. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio. Savage Son, a thriller, is available in print from Emily Bestler Books. Also available from Simon & Schuster Audio, True Believer, a thriller, written by Jack Carr and read by Ray Porter.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.